Welcome to Off the Chain. Bad news for all the regular listeners. Dave is out. He's out with his brand new twins, welcoming them into the world. He now has a total of 5 children that his wife produced in 2 births, 2 live births. So if you're looking for value or a greater bang for your buck, she's averaging 2.5 children per birth.
Per bang.
Per bang. Now, I don't know the full statistics on number of bangs they've had there in that family, but we'll have Dave get us a full report next week. I have 2 really exciting guests here today. This is timely because one of our guests today is really into quantifying everything. Ashley. Ashley
Hello.
Sanders, welcome.
Hello. 2 plus 2 is 4.
Yeah. And another one of our guests is really into
bangs, controlling
the consequences of bangs. And we're not talking about a hairstyle.
That's a perfect tagline.
Kate Kelly, so great to have you on Off the Chain.
Thanks for having me.
I want us to take a time machine back to, I think for me, it would have been the year maybe 2000. I remember going to a house. It was like every Wednesday evening. Does that sound right?
Oh, yep. It was Wednesday evenings. Yes.
And it was virtues night. And that was where I first learned about virtues ethics and where I basically had the conversations that fueled and fed me and kept me healthy and sane and hearty and hale and all those other things in Provo, Utah, once upon a time. Tell me about that house. How did the two of you meet and how did virtues night come to be?
Well, I'm just laughing for all you listeners out there. It's really kind of hilarious to think that like a bunch of people went to college and instead of like drinking and partying and whatever, they started a virtues night. It's like the nerdiest thing in the universe. But
stone cold sober. That's where we were.
Stone cold sober and ethical. But yeah, so I got to BYU and I grew up in Salt Lake. But even though I grew up in Salt Lake, I didn't understand how weird Provo, Utah was.
No.
And I got there and I was like, oh no, what have I done? And I realized I like no one to talk to about any of the things I was interested in. So basically I decided to start a discussion night that was like then eventually called Virtues Night, where everybody came to the first one and they said the virtue that was the most important to them. And it could be any virtue in the world, weird virtues, normal virtues, whatever. And then they had to present on that virtue and we would end up discussing it. So it's basically like a dog whistle for all the nerds in the land, and they came running and we would spend our Wednesday evening arguing late into the night about things like, you know, vigilance or I don't know, wealth redistribution. So that's how it all started. And then I met Kate, how did we meet?
I think we met through a mutual friend. Her name was Amy, and I met her on a BYU study abroad to London. I think I came back from my mission to Barcelona, Spain, for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and she had all these new great friends for me to meet, and so I just, like, harvested her crop of friends, and one of them was you, and I started going to what then became called Discussion Night.
Wait, so you were going to discussion night before you lived in this house. I remember you guys lived, were you not roommates? Didn't you live in that house?
We lived together, yeah, after that.
We were, yeah, Kate came to the first discussion night she ever came to, and I will forever tease her about this till the end of time. She came with her boyfriend, and her boyfriend's like main thing is that he was anti-recycling. Like,
oh, I remember this guy.
Yeah, you were what, there.
I was at that discussion night.
That was the first time I hung out with our other fine guest, Kate, and he let us have it all about the reasons recycling was terrible, and Kate was on board with him, and she was just giving us the gospel.
I had been emotionally scarred by recycling program.
Yeah, so. I can understand.
Haven't we all? I mean,
I was a member of Eco Response at the time, and there was like there's 4 of us who would meet every week that were like, and there was like the director of recycling services at BYU is this really nice, earnest guy, and he was our like faculty sponsor, and so there's like 4 of us that would meet and talk about recycling, and And then I went to this meeting and I was like, oh man, I wish I had some statistics from that whatever the director of recycling was, because he said it's really efficient. We're not actually wasting all this money. They do a lot of they recycle a lot of stuff from the lawn mowing, but I didn't have anything on hand. I didn't have the numbers to crunch.
How could
I have a feeling he wouldn't have listened to you anyway.
Separate debate I had with him, he also argued that women were biologically / inherently / genetically predisposed to be bad at math.
Oh, well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Lawrence Summers, I think he started that one.
Yeah, he's big into that. And his big thing was like, do you have a trash problem? Just cap it. Like, put a green hill over it. And it's like, you know, any problem, just cap it.
Cap it.
I was so impressed with Kate from that obviously we became fast friends. And then we became roommates. It all starts with not recycling, kids. Want a friend? Stop recycling.
It's the truth.
I think of this. I think of Virtues Night as the proto off the chain. I'll be really honest. Every week, Dave and I get together. We talk about a series of things that we appreciate. And it really is driven by utilitarian virtue ethics. I mean, just about everything that we talk about on the show. So in a way, I have you, Ashley, to thank. And in a way, Kate, I have you to thank as the kind of primal, primordial opposition in all things that really provided the spark and kept me going.
The anti-good.
Yeah.
But that was one of the good things about, because we were all just like, it's such a funny thing to describe now, but we were all just like these really idealistic,
yes,
like proto-hipsters before hipsters existed. We just wanted to like talk about the issues and do things and learn things, and like we all transformed. We had this transformation period from being very active conservative LDS people to not, and it's just such a funny environment to become like radicalized in.
Yeah.
But we like did it for each other. I don't know. It's very funny to describe, but
I feel like the best adjective for me, Kate, about this was we were all profoundly illusioned. You know, like you talk about people becoming disillusioned. This was the era of like peak illusioning. And it was really quite entrancing. Like it was at the time it felt really exciting, and the world was charged and alive with this kind of supernatural possibility and lots of other possibilities. But I think that's probably in hindsight. It was the era of peak illusionment, maybe.
I completely agree. We were super, super earnest. And we were in college and we could be earnest. And yeah, I often think about strident things that I or somebody else said at discussion night as I ease into my 30s and just lose all hope, you know?
The thing that's baffling is the other thing that seemed operational is that I don't ever recall encountering any irony. Like, mm-hmm, almost no irony. And that's the thing where you talk about proto-hipsters. I'm like, I recoiled instantly. I was like, there was almost no irony. Like, the earnestness that Ashley was describing was in maximum effect. I never heard anyone, like, saying something sarcastic or, like, not believing in something because it was, like, too earnest or something. It was like an irony-free zone. It was like David Foster Wallace's ideal future state or whatever.
He was just always there presiding.
So anyway, we went on way too long for our listeners. Who's going to care about that? But what we have now, we have a special segment, recurring segment. This is called Small Talk. And in Small Talk, each of us contribute some anecdote or story that will help you, listener, in your next awkward conversation. Ash, I think you have something that is extraordinarily off the chain. And I want to know more about this email listserv that you're on.
So I live in New York, and when I got to New York, I got on this radio listserv where you can find information about jobs and blah 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 and like, you know, show topics and things like that. And so usually pretty boring fare, but I get on the other day and somebody shares something from, I believe it was the Today Show. Can I get sued for slander on this? What's the law on this, Kate? I could say like a giant show that must not be named. But anyway, they sent out on the email chain that said, we want to do a show on child abduction, what to do and what not to do in the event of child abduction.
Hold on. And when you say what to do and not to do, from whose perspective are we talking about? Is this from the abductor? This is like, we want to do like pro tips for child abduction?
The strange thing is that this is for the abductee.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of like, I don't know, so you can
review
afterwards.
Lots of kids watching the Today Show.
traumatized from being abducted, you can also blame yourself for not having done it very well or something.
Got it.
But anyway, so they were looking for parents who would let their kid come on the Today Show. And the deal was that the kid would know that he was going to be pretend abducted, like practice abducted, but he wouldn't know when or how, and that he would be abducted. And then there would be a pro, I don't know, a pro in what? Like a pro in traumatizing children, I don't know. But he would be standing by this pro and he would be giving live tips about like what could have
been done better.
Yeah. And then,
this is Dave live from the fake abduction. I want you to notice kids' body language is all off here.
Yeah, and so the deal was that they weren't even offering money. They basically said, you'll get 5 minutes of fame on our show. Nice. And we are looking into it, but we are possibly going to throw in a couple free martial arts classes as well. They're looking into it because those are expensive. And the Today Show has a lean budget.
So were there a ton of reply all responses? Because that's what the best part of an it listserv is for me, when it goes reply all and it just becomes a disaster.
There were like 72 reply alls. And some people were so funny. Some people were just morally outraged. It was like, this is Susan's mother from somewhere in Indiana. This is like ridiculous. And people like, I'm going to call the Today Show. And other people had a more tongue-in-cheek reaction. Yeah. Oh, man, we all felt so moral that day because we knew that we would not have called for a fake child abduction. So we were better than somebody, you know?
So did they find the volunteer, and did this air on the Today Show? Let's name it as many times as possible.
You'll have to wait.
Tune in tomorrow.
You'll have to wait and see, but we can ask my mom because she watches the Today Show every single morning and has actually asked me after I moved to New York to go and hold a sign in like the window behind so she can see me.
Proof of life video.
So she will be the first to know if this is aired. I don't think that they got any takers from our listserv, but there are many more listserv fish in the sea. I'm sure they found somebody. Yeah.
That show's got big tentacles.
Yeah.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. I don't know if I have anything that competes with that. How about you, Kate?
No.
Come on.
I don't even know if this is terrible small talk, but
this child abduction is a great topic. So
the other day I was on a different podcast in front of a live audience, and
you're definitely gonna bleep the name of it if you mention it, because we'll talk about Today Show, but not direct competitors in our media space.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, Mormon Stories cannot have these 7 listeners. So I was in front of a live audience in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I explained what a dental dam is and how to use it. And I would say like 50% of the audience was like older couples.
They're like elbowing each other. Honey, I knew we should have tried that out.
Like probably never have discussed sex, period, in their lives ever. Mm. And I was just like, what has my life become? What has my life become?
You're like a local Dr. Ruth.
Can you give us your spiel? Maybe some people listening to this show don't know what a dental dam is.
Okay, so I work at Planned Parenthood, and I brought these safe sex kits because it was a show all about sex. That's a teaser for later, guys. Get excited.
Ooh.
Sex on this show.
I know I am.
And
you introduced a loaded gun in Act 1. My webcam doesn't work, though. I'm sorry to disappoint you, Kate.
I brought the sex kits, and they had condoms, and they had lube, and then they also had dental dams. And I was like, I pulled them out, and I was like, oh, and this is a dental dam, blah, blah, blah. And they're like kind of giving me weird looks. So I was like, a dental dam is used to prevent sexually transmitted infections via oral sex, blah, 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 blah. And then I said, but you can also turn a condom into a dental dam by cutting it into a rectangle, but you've got to be careful, blah, 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 blah. Anyways, I was
like appealing to the craftiness in Mormons.
I know.
You can also your own dental dam.
This has a DIY appeal. You can't deny.
Yeah, it really does. I wonder whether Sensi is going to start making dental dams in their 2017 product.
So there we were.
Wow, Kate. So my big question for you was, before you went, Did you have to like brush up? You have study tips at Planned Parenthood to make sure they coach you on all the subversive things that they wanted you to get in that half hour? Or was it just kind of like do it yourself?
They were like, because this is going to be really important. Make sure you mention the dental dams.
Okay.
Yeah, they're like, bring a car full of bananas if you can. If you can.
It's so funny because, I mean, Ashley knows this more better than anyone probably, but a scant 6 months ago, bare minimum, you know, a year ago, I would never, never, never talk about sex publicly. And by public, I mean with more than one person. This was not my life.
I believe you called yourself the Susan B. Anthony of sex or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know that, but I feel like
I always keep the top button buttoned.
I only have sex while reading my Bible.
That's changed all the male pronouns to female pronouns.
Because it turns you on. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a whole new era of small talk for me.
Wow. Hey, well, that I would have to say mine segues really nicely into this. I was reading about this guy named Robert Graham. He was the inventor essentially of shatterproof eyeglasses. So I guess all of us have a little bit to thank for not having shards of glass in our eye. But he made millions of dollars. And then with his millions, he decided first that he wanted to try to start his own utopian island that was going to be like, he was going to basically like kidnap the best of society, scientists and other people. They would go there, they would form their own government, and they wouldn't have to deal with us, the friction of dealing with all the idiots that we have to deal with all the time. He strangely wasn't able to convince that many Ubermensch to come join his island. And so because that plan failed, plan B was the repository for germinal choice. Have either of you frequented the repository?
I'm still thinking that this island is a utopia spelled E-Y-E-L-A-N-D. Because that would be right?
Yeah, you see it like in neon. Come on down to the island.
Based on my eyeglass fortune.
If your frames break, your money back. There you go. So in any case, what it is was essentially he wanted to start, instead of taking people to the island, he wanted to bring the island to us. And what he really wanted to do is he wanted to empower women. He said, this is not fair. Your doctor is choosing, they're screening the sperm that you might select to impregnate yourself with. What I want to do is let women sign up to get the sperm of vetted and proven Nobel laureates and other genius scientists in their field. I want to bring eugenics. I want to combine the very best of free market capitalism, women's choice, and eugenics all in one. And it's the repository for germinal choice. And essentially, it was a racist sperm bank for people with super high IQs. I had never heard of this, but apparently a couple of hundred of children... That's not a good sentence. Let me rewind that. A couple hundred children. I didn't need the extra. Oh, I don't.
Yeah, they'll never let your sperm into the bank. That was a terrible sentence.
A hundred of children.
Hundreds of children.
So anyway, a couple hundred children were born as the result of this effort, and many of them are now in their 20s. And so in the next 10 or 20 years, I think we're going to start seeing them taking over the U.S. Senate.
Wow.
Is there any, and you get a Nobel Prize for a lot of different things. Are there any, you know, standards here? Are we weeding out any of the...
I'm not so bothered by the racism as just the selection.
Here's the... Kate, this is a really great question. I did a little bit of digging. So I can tell you, he didn't... There's only one verified Nobel Prize donor. He tried to get more. And then he realized that most of the people that had received Nobel Prizes were on the older end of the age spectrum. And so he wasn't likely to get as much volume or as high quality of sperm from these older donors. And so he just said, okay, it'll be university professors, but the Nobel Prize thing is the kind of advertising copy that gets women through the door. They come for the Nobel donors. They stay for the young, virile outdoor scientists. And that was an intentional choice of phrasing there too. Come for the Nobel. Anyway, you know what I mean?
Stay and have pillow talk with the young virile scientists. Yeah.
So But the thing is, there's a guy that wrote a book maybe 10 years ago about this, and he tried to research and track down all of the children from that were produced through this repository of germinal choice and find out people's motivations and what's happened with these, how many children were born from this and what all happened. So I didn't read the book, so I don't know, but it seemed fascinating. All I have is small talk. This isn't
right. I'm taking
talk.
It into deep territory. You would have left and gotten another drink by now if we were at a party.
You need a dissertation.
We really do.
That's
so
our kind of small talk.
So that's a little taste of small talk. We've got dental dams. We've got Today Show inspired fake child abductions, and we have insane millionaire shatterproof eyeglass magnate turned sperm bank founders.
Which is a lifetime movie, probably.
You will be the center of attention at the next party. You got three things in your pocket. You're ready to go. Time's come, ladies. We need to transition into our current obsessions. And this was an unexpected segment, but it is the one I'm probably second most excited for this episode. I want to hear what you are obsessed with.
Okay. Well, let's start on one that Ashley and I are both always good at. I would say it's like one of our central obsessions is always changing our minds.
Nice. Now, what do you mean by this?
I can't think of many. Well, I know a lot of former Mormons, so it's like a biased sample. And I know a lot of people have changed their minds about a lot of things, but I don't know. Like, I think we're both pretty, really solid contenders for people who have changed their minds about the most things in the shortest period of time.
Wow.
Huh. So I used to be a staunch Republican who met Ann Coulter in real life and admired her. And worked on such things as trying to keep the U.S. from ratifying CEDAW and supporting the Reagan Ranch in California.
Mm. It's
stunning that you know what CEDAW is. I'm not even sure. I'm like, CEDAW.
CEDAW. Yep. CEDAW. CEDAW.
Tell the listeners what it is, Kate.
The precursor to SeaWorld, I think. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Just orcas everywhere.
Not only did I know what CEDAW was, I knew that it was evil and that I should fight it. So CEDAW is the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women.
Oh.
It's an international
treaty.
Yeah, boo.
Stupid.
Who wants to end discrimination against women?
Sounds like a conspiracy.
It was adopted in 1979, the year before I was born. And has been ratified by, I think, every country except for, like, three. It's, like, United States, like, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, and, like, I don't know, one other women-hating country.
I think they're called the Big Three, actually, where I come from. The Big Three.
We're the Big Three. And so, yeah, so very few countries. Out of the 196 recognized nation states, very few countries have not ratified CEDAW, and we are one of them.
Nice.
And I wanted to keep it that way.
So I think it's fair to say that that's an issue on which you may have changed your mind. But what do you think is underlying this? Why be obsessed with changeability? Doesn't that just mean you're fickle, Kate?
That's one of the things that I actually hate when people say that about politicians. They're like, oh, they're flip-floppy, like blah, blah, blah. Like there's a difference between opportunistic and genuine. But it's important to change your mind. Like, if you hated gay people in the 80s and now you don't, I think that's a good thing, etc. Like, there are a lot of different things you could change your mind about as long as it's genuine and it's not, you know, there are clear examples of just being opportunistic. So, yeah, I think it's really important to change your mind about a lot of things. And it's so funny to me because I always thought most people were like that. Like, I was like, oh, yeah, okay, most people probably change their minds about a lot of things because they're constantly thinking. And we had this discussion group in college and, you know, we were always like interrogating ideas. And I said that to a friend of mine who went to Harvard Law. And I was like, you know, I think that's probably pretty normal, blah, blah, blah. He's like, no, it's not normal. Like, most people are born liberal or conservative and will die liberal or conservative. And, like, never interrogate the ideas and just, like, use all of their arguments to, like, satisfy their own self-satisfaction or their like self-congratulatory life.
So I want to know for both of you, and I feel like I probably in my own self-description kind of resemble that. Like I am always vigilant about confirmation bias when I'm reading stuff, and I'm thinking about the psychological effect of stuff that I'm reading, and I want to constantly be measuring my evidence against other available evidence and seeing what I really believe. But for you, what's your kind of basic orientation to having your mind changed? Do you feel like you want to go through life constantly open, like you're looking for reasons to change your mind? Or do you feel like when you encounter something, you are prepared to change your mind, but you want to proceed as though you are correct with what you know? Like, I think there's kind of two ways. I proceeding with uncertainty and ready to change my mind when needed, or I proceed with certainty, but I'm willing to change my mind if I encounter something.
I think I'm the latter. This past summer I was in a group and it was like about confrontation styles or something. I don't remember what. And then to introduce ourselves, we had to go around the room and say like, okay, what's your confrontation style? And I was like the first of 30 people. And so I was like, I don't know. Just like pretty matter of factly, I was like, I think I'm just like gladiator style confrontation, you know, just like get in the ring, fight to the death. And then everyone else like moves on, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, okay. No one else. All right. I was like, I thought that would be a more popular style.
You really primed the room too. You gave them a chance to say, yeah.
You like Overton windowed everybody. Everybody felt fine about how aggressive they were after that.
I was like, okay, never mind. So I think I'm like, I really like engaging in conversation. I think that's the way I change my mind the most. I will fight to the death an idea. And then in the end, if the other person has persuaded me that their idea is better, even though I fought to the death, I'm like, all right, you emerge victorious. And then I change my mind. I don't know. Maybe that's not a good description. What is that what you would say, Ash?
Yes.
You're like the Platonic ideal of a law school student.
Yeah, just Socrates her to death. No, that's completely how Kate is. And got to bring it hard. If she crashes into it enough and she breaks. Yeah, that's what I think. And I think that I'm a mix. Like, it really depends on the day. I wouldn't say that I'm, like, you know, going forth a child of the universe being like, well, maybe, maybe, maybe not. I think both Kate and I are extremely passionate about what we've decided to believe, but we want people to, like, bring their best shit. Can I say bring their best shit? Okay. Anyway, so, like, we want them to be like, have you read this? What about this? I think this. Have you considered this? And in that sense, I might even get annoyed, but ultimately that's the kind of style I like. Like when I was younger, I always, you know, I grew up Mormon and the culture there is like very nice, don't disagree. And I was like way more into the idea of kind of like I met this woman in New York who's Jewish and she told me, she's like, so what's it like to be in a nice family? And she was like super intrigued about Mormons. And I was like, well, what is it like in your family? She's like, oh, no one ever agrees. Dinner is just like, you think that? How could you think that? Blah, and back and forth. And we just came from both of like the stereotypical Jewish and Mormon households. And we both wanted to swap lives. Like, I want to sit at the dinner table and have my like father interrogate me and to like argue philosophically with him. That's my idea.
So I think this is really interesting because I feel like this is part of why I feel both, I was really attracted to both of you as people and as thinkers, because I do think that ideas, I can tell that ideas really charge and motivate you in both in different ways, but that neither of you seemed particularly dogmatic about preserving a broken idea. And that's refreshing. I also feel like when you're engaging and conversing and arguing with the person who is oriented that way, you can disagree vociferously without that charge of personal animus that often comes with disagreements. And that's something that I really appreciate. Like, I feel like I like being a little contrary and I like disagreeing, but I never mean anything personal by it. And in fact, I usually end up feeling generally quite excited by the person who I've had that kind of charged disagreement with. And I think that's atypical. And I remember several times being like, I just had a big disagreement with someone, coming off being like, that was exciting. And they're thinking, that person's an asshole. So finding like-minded people has been really helpful for me to realize, okay, here's where I need to tone this down. But when I have someone who's ready to do this, let's go. Let's have like a gladiatorial contest without trying to kill the other person. I'm just trying to kill the idea.
That's what I think. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Kate.
I was going to say it's hard online.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. You can't.
People don't know you and they don't know like, oh God, like, you know, they don't know. In the end, I'm like, okay, if you like present the best argument or whatever, I'll change my mind, but I will fight you to the death until that happens. And so like the other day, someone who is autistic, I had a conversation with her and she said, well, you know, blah, 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 people who are autistic like us, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, wait, rewind. And she's like, yeah, I mean, I just heard from so many people that you're autistic that I didn't even think to ask you. I just assumed that it was true. And I was like, interesting. I'm not. But that's really funny that you would say that. And long story short, basically, like people on that, a lot of people that I knew online exclusively or people that I hadn't met in person assumed, and this is like also pretty ableist and crappy in other ways, assumed that because the way that I interacted with them like made them uncomfortable, that I was autistic. And so she was like, and she was, she's like fully autistic. And she said, she was like, I was so confident that you were, that I didn't even think to ask you. I just assumed because so many people had told me that you were. And so I think it's funny. It's hard to articulate like your personality in an online forum, especially if you're online, or especially if your personality involves like any sort of gladiatorial aspect.
So this is a great segue because Ashley, one of your obsessions was in fact the internet / AI. Let's talk about this obsession for you. We don't have to directly tie it to Kate's point. We can leave that one hanging untied out there. Kate's pseudo-autism.
A gladiator swinging in the air.
But when we design our KateBot 2.0, we'll know not to give it any empathy, any online empathy.
Yeah, well, so I don't know. I think maybe one aspect of this, what we were just talking about for me, is that I pursue ideas really hard, even though they scare me.
Yes.
And it's a weird relationship because if something scares people, a lot of them are like, I don't want to read about that. And I'm like, all right, I've looked up every Dewey Decimal section of the library and I've checked out everything and I'm reading it, crying in my room, you know?
So like, let's do this. Is there an intellectual charge for you? Is it an erotic charge? What's the charge for pursuing the things that you're afraid of? Is that okay to talk about?
Oh, yes. Erotic charges are always okay to talk about. Yeah, I think it's like, I think it is erotic. I love to learn. I love to disagree. I love to hear what other people are thinking. Yeah, I don't know. I think cultural criticism is one of the most interesting things to me. But I also just want to know. Like, I think that's something that Kate and I talk a lot about, is like, it's not like I'm never protective of my ideas or I never get hurt. But I would say, ultimately, I really just want to know. Like, I want to know all the ideas out there and I want to, like, look at them clearly and then make a decision about what to do. So I think it's a lot of things, but like the internet is one of those things. Like, I use it, I'm using it right now, but I am really, really terrified of like the future of artificial intelligence, data, internet, whatever. And so as a result, I'm reading all about it all the time.
Like, here's an example for me, machine learning. And I don't know if you've been following the triumph of Google's Go playing machine.
Yes,
it finally,
totally.
It beat this other European champion, and then it beat Lee Sedol, who's like the world's best Go player, in four out of five games. And reading in detail about this, because it was one of those constraint-based games that they thought AI would take a long, long time to be able to beat humans at. It was more complex than chess. Mm-hmm. And I think there is something for especially rule-bound domains and kind of constraint-based games and activities. Machine learning is both really awesome and super terrifying because of the devastating human impact and the unequal distribution that it promises.
Yeah, it's really intense. I was reading an article in The New Yorker the other day called The Internet of Us.
Yes.
Have you read that?
You posted that. I read it. I was quite intrigued too.
Kate, have you heard of that or read it? Oh, not reading my Facebook page, huh? Fine. We can still be friends.
I've got 5,000 other friends to take
yeah,
care
seriously.
Oh, okay. All right.
Kate runs the social media empire now.
Well, Kate, if you happen to think of me ever while you're online, it's on my page.
You deign to consider.
But it's basically about, I mean, it's actually one of the most well-written articles I've read in a long time, but it's about it starts off talking about the elections and about truth and what truth is and like how we came to think of truth as something that could be fact checked versus like in older times, truth was like something more medieval. Like you could, and you'll like this, Kate, a lot of truth was settled by combat, you know, yes, like by people fighting it out or by ordeal, you know, like put someone in water and if they drown, then they're a witch or whatever. And that it's a pretty modern idea that we can settle things by referencing facts, like did it actually happen, et cetera. So the article is about our ability to reason and the newness of this idea of reasoning. And then it talks about how in the future, if, for example, we can implant an internet chip in our brain and then, you know, have a question and have an answer instantaneously come to our brain, like what does that mean for human beings and what does it mean for our capacity to reason? And is that a terrifying idea? And I guess I'm just very interested in ideas that are powerful enough to make us feel afraid or make us react very strongly. And I think I react very strongly to that.
So, Ash, there's a really kind of connected piece that I read about, and it was William Languisha. I don't know how you say his last name. I think he's a staff writer for Vanity Fair and Esquire, and like he's like a long-form journalist that's real serious. He wrote this article about this plane crash, and it was, I think, an Air France plane that crashed. And essentially what happened was the autopilot system failed, and there was no reason for this plane to crash except essentially that there was a series of really gross pilot errors that were made over time, and they compounded. And the central argument is that these pilots never should have made these very basic errors, but essentially their piloting capacities to do this manually had profoundly atrophied in the presence of automation. And that's just kind of a principle that's generally true, that in the presence of automation, automation replaces these capacities. We no longer do it as frequently. And when we no longer do a thing as frequently, our ability to do it under stress and duress and pressure diminishes. That's a trade that's totally worth making 99% of the time. But in the instances of like the failure of the automated system, we're going to have sometimes really serious consequences because we have a complex system that is designed to run automatically. And then how do we keep up the ability to coordinate it manually when needed? And I think that was the kind of thought experiment in this article too. What if the server goes down and you can no longer recall those facts? Are we just going to be like these stumbling, drooling morons?
Wow.
Because we've outsourced our thinking to them.
That's so interesting. It reminds me, I tried is the active verb. I tried to do a 10-day silent meditation a year and a half ago. And all, you know, you don't have your phone, you don't have the internet. You just sit and meditate all day and your brain just gets filled with things. And I had question after question after question come up and I couldn't check the internet. And it made me realize like how much my brain has become dependent on immediate knowledge and checking the internet. And then I had to spend all my time that I was supposed to spend being enlightened, trying to figure out answers to these questions. I don't know if you guys remember this, but when I first started college at BYU, there was something, it's like right as the internet was becoming like a main kind of teaching tool in college. And there was something called the 100 hours board. Do you guys remember this?
Yeah, I remember it at BYU.
Yeah.
Like so, call it, or was it email or call? And you could do it.
You could put, what I remember is if you had a question, you could write it on a note card and you would stick it to the 100 hours board wall. And then a team of nerds would retrieve it. And they basically had 100 hours to answer your question and get it back up on the board. And so like it was like a team of friends. I wish so bad I could have done this. They were basically like a human proto computer. They were trying to answer your question faster than you could. That's just interesting to me because it kind of was like the last gasp of we can do it as our brains. And then somebody told me that they're on the internet now, but that kind of feels like Ask Jeeves. Like, why are you going onto the internet to ask someone to Google something for you? I don't know.
So anyway, Here's a kind of small story related to that. So my sister, my wife's sister just moved to Madison. She got a part-time job as an adult services librarian at a public library. And essentially she's like the reference desk. And like more than half of the questions are people coming to ask her to Google stuff for them, basically.
Okay,
like, hey, would you look
back.
This up for me? And so like the reference desk is still alive and well in some ways, but maybe not for our class of thinker.
Good. That's our last stand against the robots.
Yeah, the reference desk.
The reference desk.
Valiant.
It's so scary, though, to think about, like, who controls the information on the other end. As someone who very recently had a Wikipedia page created on me, And I don't know anyone, you know, I don't know how to do Wikipedia, and I don't know like who the people are who create it because they're all pseudonyms. But I'm like, how is this like what they distilled about my life? Like, this is not what I would write about my own Wikipedia page, but also like really like detailed. And like, I don't know, it's kind of insane. Like, how does a hive create information and then it becomes fact? Like someone, you know, people will be like, oh, it's on your Wikipedia page. I'm like, ah,
delete.
I really got to learn how to Wikipedia, because
there was a feminism code and power event here in Madison at the public library. It was women in Wikipedia. They had like a Wikipedia hackathon all day at the library where a bunch of women learn how to edit Wikipedia, because there's a huge gender imbalance in Wikipedia editors. It's like 85% to 15%.
Yeah, but that's like a great example of like, how is that, like, that's our brain now. Like, how many people go beyond Wikipedia to be like, I wonder if that's really true?
And that means if any of your enemies are listening to the show, Kate, they can go into your page and be like, Kate loves patriarchy. Kate, blah, blah, blah.
She doesn't know how to use Wikipedia. She said it. It's a fact.
Citation to this show.
No, we won't do that.
Yeah. Don't worry, my enemies have already found that page.
Good.
Someone told me it was one of the most contested Wikipedia pages they'd ever seen. Because you have to go back and forth on the fact.
Kate, I'm sorry. I think in lots of ways becoming a public figure is the thing that I would dread. And I don't know, I don't have the stomach for the gladiatorial combat that I think you clearly demonstrated. But thank you on behalf of lots of people.
Yeah, guys, I brought you one hell of a Wikipedia page.
You really did. Carve that on my tombstone, my epitaph. Let it be written of me. All right, so can I tell you about one of my obsessions?
Yes, please.
I've been in graduate school for like a decade. I'm a perpetual student. And the thing that I came here to study, well, I didn't come here, but the thing that I've told people that I would study to get my dissertation completed, a PhD, are a group of poets that are called the Objectivist Poets. And they're active from the 1930s through the mid-70s, with like a 20-year gap in the middle, from most of them from like 1940 to 1960, 1945 to 65, were totally, they left poetry for a while to become, most of them were like left-wing communist social activists and stuff. But their big concern for many of them was this factuality. Like, the obsession was not with the self, but it was with the world of objects and real things that were not me. And the poem was an act of attention towards them, an act of description in some ways, but really, like, they were very concerned with objects in the world and with facts. And one of the poets that's most interesting in this group is this guy named Charles Reznikoff, this tiny New Yorker, beautiful little Jewish guy, loved walking, and he self-published, probably 24 books from a hand press in his basement. But he was also trained as a lawyer. He went to law school, but decided that he didn't like the act of contesting, the winning and losing of legal battles. And so he worked for many years as like a editor for a legal encyclopedia. He published 2 books of very important documentary poetry, where he was trying to record only facts in this very like legal language of facts that you were talking about earlier, Ash. One of them is called Testimony, a Recitative, and it's, I think, a 35-year period of American history where he just read case law from 1880 to 1915, and then he presents a history of America that's basically just taken from court records of essentially violence, racism, all these horrible, terrible things that we think about as new inventions. He's just documenting with only the language of testimony born in, like, in court. It's extraordinary and it's harrowing. It's like 450 pages of legal records as poetry in this documentary style. The other book that he did was called Holocaust. And this is 20 years before Claude Lanzmann releases Shoah, but it's essentially Holocaust testimony. And he's documenting the destruction or the murder of European Jews in this book of poems. It's like, and it's just the language essentially of bearing testimony in this incredible, incredible way. So they're one of my obsessions, and I encourage everybody to be obsessed with them. Check out Charles Reznikoff as a poet, as a human, and read these books.
How did people respond to these poems of his?
By not buying them, mostly. No, So with Testimony, this was part of this big return that these poets made in the 60s. And so George Oppen, who's one of my other heroes, he intervened on Reznikoff's behalf. He loved Reznikoff and loved what Reznikoff stood for. And so he intervened so that the press New Directions, which was a major American poetry publisher, published the first couple of volumes of Testimony. But then it didn't sell super well, so they dropped him. And then he just went back to his basement and just kept publishing them by hand, a couple hundred copies, and give them to friends and give them to libraries. And he didn't care. But Testimony had some impact. And then it was out of print for 40 years. And then just last year, Black Sparrow, this really nice publisher of kind of intelligent books, just brought Testimony back into print about a year and a half ago. So it was out of print. I never owned a copy. I had to read library copies, but I finally bought a copy last year and they brought it back into print.
Wow. I love that.
Number one, you'd be really good friends with my boyfriend, Jack. You guys should meet.
Set it up.
Ashley introduced me to. Like, Session Night was also like a Mormon hub for like Mormon radicals to meet each other and get married. I think Ashley had like 7 marriages.
Oh, yeah. I'm a matchmaker. Intellectual matchmaker.
That's how I met my first husband and my current boyfriend, is through Ashley.
Repository for germinal choice, Ashley.
I am. I have met my competition and I am going to dominate.
This bank is open.
The bank is open.
Radical Mormon, post-Mormon hipsters. Second thing, speaking of Mormonism, we should do a history of the Mormon church through only testimonies, like born in church.
Oh, man. That would be unreadable, but amazing.
Oh, that's why it would be amazing.
But I love that, Steele. I really want to read that, and I'm also, like, it's kind of relieving, right, to, like, everybody's been writing about themselves nauseatingly for centuries, and then some people just decide to stop writing about themselves. That feels like a relief. But I'm also trying to imagine, like, the open mic night with Reznikoff, you know? Like, getting up and just laying some legal documents down.
And he's just, picture this tiny, bespectacled Jewish dude with, like, a high-pitched, not great reading voice. That's him. It's amazing. He's such a lovely dude. But probably not going to lead the slam poetry revolution into the 21st century.
Kate, I feel like you could get down with some poetry based in, like, legal history.
She was nodding over her yogurt. I think she was into it.
Excellent.
Sorry, I'm trying to surreptitiously. I'm doing this over my lunch break.
Kate, this is perfect because Dave audibly eats on every one of our episodes. It's like candy or chips or something like that. So you're keeping the long tradition alive. We don't have high standards of audio fidelity. Don't worry.
It's actually called open mouth breathing, you know?
Open mouth breathing. Yeah, it's a new website.
I chose a silent food. You've got to give me that.
Kate, I didn't know about it, and I'm here. That's great.
You've been a tremendous guest so far. Don't worry. We need to make a transition, though, and these obsessions have got my mind spinning a million miles an hour. We're going to try to go a little bit more rapid fire with expert testimony here. Are you guys both okay for time?
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed I'm using gendered language. I'm saying guys all the time. Look at me. In your presence, I've become aware of one of my speech quirks. I'm going to work on it. Mm-hmm. Okay.
We're mad at you, but we're just judging you silently.
Exactly.
So, it's a first, Kate. It's a first.
Yeah, you're missing out, man.
I know.
Kate and I are gossiping by holding up post-it notes about you to each other.
I can see your video. You just can't see mine. It's very like invisible eyeball-y of me, a very big brother. Okay, expert testimony. Both of you are experts in many things. And the first one I want to know, what do you do for a living these days?
I am a lawyer and I work for Planned Parenthood. So I try to keep laws of men off of our bodies, and I try to start conversations about safe sex in Utah.
Wow. So you work for Planned Parenthood Utah or Planned Parenthood, the national organization, or where are you working?
So the local organizations are affiliates of Planned Parenthood Federation, and so I work for the Planned Parenthood Association of Utah.
Cool. And Ash, how do you pay for that penthouse in the sky?
Just mostly inheritance money.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you know. No, I am a freelance writer. I write for a law firm. I write all their legal briefs. And then I write for travel and tourism magazines, like glossy magazines about where to get the best ice cream and stuff like that in different places. And then I write, this is a niche market, but I write humorous travel freelance stuff. where I just make jokes about tourism a lot, and that's my favorite one. Sorry, everybody else who's listening. Yes.
So, are all Ash? Are these all bylines, or are they anonymous? Are you a ghostwriter for this stuff?
For the first two, well, for the legal stuff, yeah, I'm just the ghost in the machine of legal briefs.
What is the word? Amanuensis or whatever?
Amanuensis, exactly.
Amanuensis. There you go.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't get any names on things turned into judges. For the middle one, I do have my name on it. And then for the last one, sometimes yes, sometimes no. It depends on if I write a long one or a short one. So for example, I'm writing a piece on going to the sun tunnels in Utah, which are these weird tunnels where that line up with the sun on solstice. I will get my name on that. Don't worry.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. So very interesting, but not very lightning. Come on, Ash. Pick it up. Okay.
Sorry.
Did you go to law school, Ash?
Oh, no. I was trained in writing legal briefs in 3 weeks over Skype. It felt like my brain was bleeding on the inside, and then they threw me in the water with all the sharks. It was terrifying.
Is neurological bleeding a requirement of having a JD, Kate?
Ashley probably knows more about writing legal briefs than I do. I'm basically like a glorified party planner.
Oh, sweet.
So, fine. I did go to law school.
So here's my follow-up question then, Kate. Was going to law school the worst decision you ever made, or just one of the worst?
I loved law school. I know not everyone does, and they have really good reasons. But I loved it. I loved law school. It's fun. I mean, if you like nerding around.
And you're sure you're not autistic?
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
I don't know. I liked it a lot. My law school was a really good time. I also learned a lot about organizing and being an activist. Mm-hmm. And really involved in the National Lawyers Guild. So I wasn't, I don't know. Basically,
you weren't a dumb law student.
I wasn't a dumb law student who makes a lot of money and has a purposeful life.
You're part of the guild, though. I mean, you got that going for you. That sounds pretty cool.
I'm a lawyer who's part of a guild and makes very little money.
Nice. I can relate. I work for the state of Wisconsin. It's a great job, but it's not on everybody's list of like treasured professions these days.
You guys can come stay in my penthouse whenever. It's fine.
Well, the gilded class has invited us in. We have an entree. All right. So the other thing that everybody knows both of you for, who knows you, is grade A style. I would say glamour or bold eccentricity, depending on who's talking, I guess. So the first question that everybody wants to know, Kate, we've had hundreds of people write in. Who makes your frames?
Hundreds. I get them from all different kinds of places. The ones that I'm wearing right now are made by Derek Cardigan, retro-looking frames.
This is going on Wikipedia, too, so be careful what you say.
Oh, no!
So Derek Cardigan, and this is online, or is this someone you know? He's a handcrafted.
They're bourgeoisie frames. I usually get them online. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a bunch of different websites. One is Zenni Optical. Another, I mean, I've also gotten frames at like a flea market in Paris, and then I had them put like my prescription in. So
okay, so you make opportunities. You're looking for beauty in eyewear, wherever it strikes you. Open mind.
I'm dedicated to cat eyes and rhinestones, no matter how I can get my hands on them.
So the second thing is, was this part of your strategy to be caricaturized by political cartoonists? Was this like was it peacocking is what they call it?
I'm playing the long game. So I just, you know, started out with poor eyesight, then
how can I be cruelly mocked for my appearance? Let's do this.
Yeah. First of all, be a woman.
Yeah, but that's a good start.
Second of all, do anything of importance.
Oh, also good. Yeah. Good call.
That's pretty much the formula.
Check and check. Okay, so second question I have for Ash. One of the things I remember about you was, I don't know, then you kind of informed me, but you were the first person, you were the vanguard, I think, on the Peter Pan pants train. And when I saw you wearing them, I was super impressed. I very much wanted them. I wanted to wear them. They looked comfortable. They flowed. They looked stylish. They looked breathable. It, to me, was like imagining a skirt that had legs kind of sewn in. So okay. I didn't have to be mindful about my undergarments or anything. And I want to know, how did you do it? And what were your tips for adopting this? Because you would have had to import them privately. Right. No one else had them back then.
Right. Well, actually, okay, so when you say Peter Pan pants, are you thinking, let's just get straight on the terms here. Are you thinking about those elastic waist, wide leg kind of pants that go like halfway down your legs?
Yes, but
stretchy,
like,
material.
Yeah, and they would have like maybe jagged hem. That's kind of what I'm imagining. Not always, they could. This is just the archetypal. This is the
version. No, yeah, we're talking about the form, like yes, the platonic form of the, yeah. Okay, so those, I call them gaucho pants. And
gaucho,
they are just
pants.
Kind of my,
very multicultural.
Yeah, very multicultural. So they're part of my ever-evolving strategy to wear elastic waistbanded pants in a socially acceptable way.
As a dad in his 30s, I can totally get behind that strategy.
Seriously,
so like, I can't feel my legs right now.
Like, always wanting to stay young, but this is like wanting to dress like an old person as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know. I got on that really early. I wouldn't ever call myself glamorous because I think actually one of our friends threw a party for me for one of my birthdays. It was an Ashley lookalike contest, and everybody basically showed up wearing Crocs, no pants, gigantic necklaces that like could like weigh your entire neck down, and just like covered themselves in glitter. Like
homemade,
they just
homemade cloth headbands too.
So many headbands that were made of cloth, and just like hair that looked like the apocalypse had happened, and then happened one.
And
more
they
event.
Had survived it though. That's the part you're leaving out. They survived that apocalypse.
I would like to note for the record that my little brother won that competition.
Heyo, shout out for that on his Wikipedia page.
Shout out for Jake Kelly. He looks the most like me when covered in glitter.
So you brought this up, and we don't have a ton of time, but this is worthy of taking a few minutes for. Costume parties, expert testimony, both are legendary. I think one of my most treasured possessions was a photograph that was on my fridge for probably 6 years of Ashley dressed as a Valentine's heart. With some cryptic lyrics from a Pat Benatar song, I believe. Does that sound familiar?
Oh, that sounds entirely too familiar. Yeah, that was actually just something that I did for Valentine's Day.
It wasn't even a party. It was just...
it was just my own. I made my brother take photos of me in the backyard.
Hey, bro,
yeah, it was a human-sized heart costume that said love is a battlefield. I had just shaved my head, which was inadvisable. And I
think
I'm blowing into a red trumpet. Yeah. And that was later put on Hot or Not by one of our friends. And I scored a solid 3.4.
Obsession with data. I upvoted that as many times as I could. I was just hitting refresh.
We all did. So it really was probably a 0.8 if we're being real with ourselves.
But I think one of the keys to our success in costumed parties is like the extreme pressure to come costume.
Yes.
Like, if you didn't wear a costume, we literally had what we called punishment costumes.
Yep.
To punish people who dared like betray us.
This
and
is
wear
not costume
clothes.
Optional.
No.
No.
Not.
No, 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 no. You had to wear a garbage bag that said, I'm stupid.
Yes. It was like the early vanguard of bullyism. Yeah, we were doing it.
This is like sorority hazing, but way cooler.
Uh-huh. Way cooler, way more traumatized.
Listen, I mean, if you're going to commit to an idea, commit.
Yes, gladiatorial. I remember a party. We want listeners to know about this. Are you okay with, are these open source ideas or are they
These are
trademarked?
So open source, and I know where you're going, and I'm so excited, Steele.
Come as a historical event. That was the single greatest idea-themed costume party I have ever heard of / been to / attended. It was one of the highlights of my life.
And can I just announce what you were, because it's still so close to my heart.
Yes. Only time I've held a gun in public.
I'm so glad. Steele came as the shot heard round the world.
I did.
And I think you had giant earphones,
yeah,
a gun, and then what else was happening? Do you remember?
So what I took was like a globe. And I took a wire hanger that was coming, one end of it was coming out of the end of the rifle, and it was tied around the globe so that there was literally a gun that had a globe coming around it and like a piece of wire coming out of the barrel of the gun and coming back. So it was like a full-on prop. And I think it was like Revolutionary Wear-style jacket, so it seemed like...
Yeah, absolutely.
And then I had my roommates who came as the stages of evolution. One was in the gorilla suit, and one was Neanderthal man, and then one was
And they were, like, holding erectus. A rope that connected them.
The four
something.
Of them were tied together. That was pretty good.
Oh, my God. That
I
was
think
amazing.
It's important to remind our listeners that we went to a school where no one drank alcohol.
Or had solid premarital point. Sex.
I mean, I don't know. You and that globe
sublimation.
Monster,
it's called sublimation.
No, Steele, you weren't the only person dressed as a globe at that party. Because I remember where I was. I was a very slow unfolding historical event. I was Pangaea.
Oh,
and so
yes!
I dressed as a world, and then I got into a mosh pit by the end of the night, and as in a feat of historical accuracy, was ripped apart.
Wow, you became Gondwana land.
I did. I really did.
Talk about tectonic shifts. Wow.
For real. Kate, why don't you just share your best costume with us?
All I remember is like one of the highlights, we had Valentine parties pretty frequently. Apparently we were really into Valentine's Day. And we had one that was the Platonic Love Fest.
Ooh.
And you had to be a love cliche. And then I remember the invite was like a cheerleader loves Twinkies
mm-hmm.
for some reason.
A true leader or a cheerleader?
Cheerleader.
Oh, cheerleaders, yeah.
Oh, you're getting them mixed up. The cheerleader and the Twinkie was when we had a love-hate party, and you had to come dressed as a love-hate Billy.
Yes,
I see. That makes more sense.
Love so hate. Much more. Okay, yeah. And for the Platonic Love Fest, I think I was Many Fish in the Sea, and I wore a ball gown and hand-sewed, like, hundreds of little fish, like, wooden fish all over the ball gown.
I was really hoping you were going to say Milton Friedman, Kate.
Next time.
Not anymore. Not that was a bygone era.
It's true. Oh, no.
You'll never have that same passion for the Chicago School of Economics, I don't think.
That may be true.
Bye. We could do a past loves party, and I could dress like Reagan.
You could pull it off, I think.
Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, for that love-hate relationship, I dressed as Freud, and I had someone do like my hair and beard for me, and then my boyfriend came dressed as the grandmother, a mother figure.
And so I already see that
I committed to that.
Gender roles, exploration of gender roles, Ashley.
Exactly.
That's the way that you have to do costume parties to be able to act out in Provo.
I know. What would Freud say about me dressing as him in order to explore that?
I believe after one of these costume parties, this is only tangentially related, but there were these like what I affectionately refer to as dude bros.
Oh,
who
nice.
Were like, who came and didn't dress in costumes and were mad at us for being smarter than them. And one of them said to me, no matter what you do in life, you'll never be anything but a hot girl.
He really put you in your place.
Yeah, good point. Really good point.
Yeah.
I can't escape this beauty.
Yeah, you just dropped the mic and walked out.
So, quick questions for our listeners out there. One, functional definition. What is style? How would you define style?
Can I say it's like pornography and I know it when I see it?
Oh.
For me right now, it just involves so much gold. Like, if it has gold in it, it's probably stylish. That's what I think.
Oh, are we talking about plating or are we talking about gold to the core?
The color. It can be a laminate or something. It's fine. A veneer is fine. It just needs to be colored gold.
Pyrite.
The thing I love about style is it says a lot about your personality.
Yes.
I think a lot of things can be communicated through like your style. Like some people are super utilitarian. Some people would rather wear gold than be comfortable, for example. Just throwing that out there. Some
not trying to make a dig at anyone in particular. Just
right. I mean,
some people. But I think fashion is a thing that like makes the body look beautiful, and that is almost never the route I go.
Do you think fashion is inherently dishonest? Is that what you're saying? Like, there's something about it that's the body is only beautiful in as much as its accessories is in place, and as soon as it's removed, everybody's like, "Oh, that's it."
No, I think fashion is like it just has a totally different aim, and like obviously it's also an industry, and one of the industries where women can do well and dominate in some aspects. Yeah, I think fashion and style are different. I think fashion is like dedicated to making like the body look beautiful and make interesting, like people think about interesting things. Whereas style, it's like, I almost never look good. I just like think things that I'm wearing are pretty.
Yeah, in that sense, style is just like the little like herald that comes ahead and is like, personality coming this way, this is what you can expect.
Yeah. So it's the thing that, it's like the stereotype threat, basically. It's clothing stereotype threat, where we're saying like, hey, just, we're going to simplify this. Look at what I'm wearing. It's going to do a little bit of the thinking for you. You get a sense before you meet me and see me, what I'm about. You're signaling. Yeah. You're doing some signaling. And I think in that sense, for those definitions, I feel like both of you really exude style. And style is something that I would be happy to identify with you. And it sounds like fashion is not really, or a pursuit, or like something that you're aspiring to. Success.
We also just don't want to insult the industry by...
Yeah.
Play it safe. I was in LA the other day, and I was on Sunset Boulevard, and I was in a shop. I was just waiting for someone. I was waiting for Jack, and I was in the store, and then the person's like, well, what do you wear? And he meant, like, what designers?
What brand?
And I was like, I don't even know how to answer that question.
For Kate, lately it's been a lot of really weird mismatched prints that she bought in Kenya made by friends.
Yeah, those were outstanding.
Like, homemade DIY dresses made out of misprint fabric from Kenya.
And he's like, are you lost?
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
Do you want a $500 bikini? All right.
Would you like our security officer to escort you out, or can you find the door? Yeah. Okay. Well, there we go. So the last thing that I really need, these are hot tips. This is going to be lightning round. So much energy, as you noted, Kate, is spent by men helpfully regulating or policing women's appearance. As we can all agree, it does a lot of good. Energy well spent. But enough already. Instead, we want some 3 pro tips from you women for our male listeners. What can they do to improve their style, to improve their look this coming year?
Okay. Well, I don't know what you look like now, so it's hard for me to tell you how to improve. But...
It doesn't stop us, Kate.
Doesn't stop. Okay, here's some things to avoid. I would say, oh God, so many options. Whoever you are, grow your hair out. Short hair is just, I don't like short hair, period. Yep. I'm a person who's like, something cool is happening and is in vogue, do it.
Okay.
Like, not like, oh, like, I don't know, it's too popular. I'm like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Like, bangs are
popular
awesome.
For a reason. Bangs. Carpe diem.
Yeah. Grow out your hair long. You get away with it at work. So grow out your hair long. Number 2 is well-tailored anything. Don't fucking buy the, like, XL and have it just, like, be baggy and gross. Like, no matter what your body type is, get something tailored. It's not just for gay men.
Neil Gaiman, by the way.
there's a reason gay men look nice. They put some effort into it. And number 3 is don't wear tennis shoes unless you're doing a sporting activity.
Wow. Respect yourself, basically, is what you're saying.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, you are not for free.
There are specialty items for specialty activities, and unless you're running around the track, I don't want to see those
Asics.
New Balance shoes.
Asics don't belong unless...
Yeah. I don't want them.
All right, Ash, you got 3 hot tips for our male listeners?
Yeah, the first one is if you look at your pants and they have more than 2 pockets on them, get rid of them.
Get rid.
Don't wear cargo pants.
But hold on, where will I put my hammer if I need to do some hammering?
When that event comes up, that is a specialty moment, and refer to Kate's rule number 3.
Okay.
You can wear cargo pants if you're hammering. Number 2, I would say watch RuPaul's Drag Race and just wear a suit like his. Like a very slim, colorful suit with a skinny tie. That would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And my last tip is probably just continue to have or start to have asymmetrical hair, because I love that.
All right, so I am currently 0-for-6 on your style tips, but I appreciate it.
Oh,
glad to be it. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
Wait, are you wearing cargo pants right now? You can tell us. We'll just get them off one time.
That's what I'm telling you. I can't feel my legs because I don't have elastic band. They're jeans that used to fit me before I had a child.
Before you were with child, I understand.
Yeah, I didn't. I mean, before my wife had a child, so it's really.
Right.
She did all the work. All right. Well, thank you for that was expert testimony. So we're going to do Unchained Melodies. This is one of my favorite things we do on the show. We play brief segments from amazing music on a variety of themes. The theme this week, it's clearly powerful, badass women. And mm-hmm. So we have some
hashtag
songs for
obviously.
You. Yeah, thank you. First hashtag we've dropped this year.
Wow,
we're trending on the Twitter this week.
Send those birds flying.
Tee, tee, tee. Who wants to start us off? Who wants to really get our engines revving here?
Kate, do it.
Okay, so the song that I chose is Alive by Sia.
Yeah, and people should go and listen to Sia's interviews on YouTube about how she became Sia and just cry into their, like, hands or something because they're so good.
I was born in a thunderstorm. I grew up overnight. I played alone, I played on my own, I survived. Hey, I wanted everything I never had, like the love that comes with life. I wore envy and I hated that, but I survived. I had a woman, it took her to a place where all the demons go. Where the wind don't change and nothing on the ground can ever grow. No hope, just lies and you're taught to cry in your pillow. But I survived.
It's blasphemous to fade it out, but I did it. So she just makes sounding like the coolest person in the room. It's like such a casual thing.
No big deal.
It's great. That's a great song.
It is a good song.
Okay, well, I'm going to start out with Toni Braxton.
Yes!
He wasn't mad enough for me. I learned about Toni Braxton from my father, whose favorite song is Unbreak My Heart. So thanks, Man. Dad.
Thanks, Dad. Good thing my video camera's off because I'm definitely not wearing pants anymore.
I just feel like if anybody out there has recently broken up with a man, they'll probably be glad they listened to that.
And the other thing is, anytime the song in like the first 10 seconds has like a third person reference to the singer, like Toni Braxton. That part was, I forgot about that. It's like, just in case you forgot whose music you're playing, this is Toni Braxton.
And it's like a whisper voice. It takes a ton of moxie and confidence to, like, you know, let them know what's about to happen.
All right, so here's my first choice. This is a very obscure band. I don't know if they're even still making music. Their name is Mattson Jones, and they're distinctive because they've got two cellists in the band. And the song is A Little Bit of Arson Never Hurt Anyone.
To see and places that I need to burn down and people that I need to burn out of my head. I know a kiss on the cheek will not take care of everything. You'd better give it to me anyways, dear. Can't
That song makes me feel just profoundly nervous every time I hear it. There's something very jagged about it, and that's a really nice, unsettling feeling.
It is. Sometimes you just need to feel jagged and unsettled.
Yeah. That is the resting state of our neoliberal age, I think.
Exactly. Also, your song showed that you're, like, at least 7.5 times cooler and more informed than Kate and me.
That's my hipster pro pick, yeah. It wasn't top 40. Like, it's okay.
Anybody listening to Braxton still? No?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe you're not a hipster, but...
But yeah, hey, it was an artist that you and your dad can bond over. That's cool.
I mean, I couldn't do James Taylor because he's a man, so I took my second option.
Honorary powerful woman. Okay.
Exactly.
All right, choice two. What else you got for us? Kate, you got a Dar Williams song.
I had to choose a Dar Williams song because if it weren't for Dar Williams, I might still be a Republican. Or think I was a Republican, at least.
False consciousness.
Yeah. So one time, Chris Foster, another mutual friend of ours, said to me, "You can't be a Republican. You listen to Dar Williams." And a non-Republican was born.
The dominoes started to fall.
The song name is As Cool As I Am.
Too hard, I think.
Yeah, there was a time I didn't like the love, I liked the climbing. She was my sister then, was running out of time and one liners. And I was afraid, like you are, way too young to know the diamond. So I watched the way you take your fear and pour the horizon. Threatened, oh, I'm not that petty. As cool as I am, I thought you'd know this already. I will not be afraid of women. I will not be afraid of women.
Hand over my heart, Kate.
Good one.
Thank you.
All right, track number two is coming at you Nina Simone's Young, Gifted, and Black.
You could have gone with anything from the Nina Simone catalog. The one movie that Laurel and I have watched in the last 2 years since having a child was the Nina Simone documentary.
It's so good.
It was really, really good.
Yeah.
Fitting. Okay, here's my last song. Speaking of Young, Gifted, and Black, this is Brittany Howard. She's famous, for, I think, from her work in the band Alabama Shakes. But she has a side project that's called Thunder Bitch. And the song is called My Baby Is My Guitar. And it's fierce.
Super. My God.
If I could do that, what I need, I would never. I would just do it all night. That would be my career. I would just do that over and over again. So there we go. Musical stylings from Powerful Women. Anything one of you wants to say to close that out?
Love it.
Okay.
Now I'm thinking of 10 Powerful Women I should have done, but it's okay.
Come back next time. We'll have Ashley's Power Hour. It's going to be right after Delilah on Late Night Talk Radio.
I hope so.
You and Ted Nugent can host an hour each.
Oh, bucket list. Yeah.
There you go. All right, book wisdom. We always end with a short, meaningful passage from a work of literature that's changed our lives or touched our hearts. And this week, Ashley, what do you have for us?
Okay, so I have something from Doris Lessing's The Golden Notebook. I'm always on the prowl to find a book that I can get Kate to read because she doesn't like novels. And this is...
Me neither.
This is... And yeah, you don't like novels. Oh my goodness. Okay, so...
We should talk about this.
This is sometime. From The Golden Notebook. It's about so many things. It's about women. It's about a woman going crazy and writing 5 different notebooks about different parts of her crazy. And this is her talking to this person she's in like with. And she says, we spend our lives fighting to get people very slightly more stupid than ourselves to accept truths that the great men have always known. They have known for thousands of years that to lock a sick person into solitary confinement makes him worse. They have known for thousands of years that a poor man who is frightened of his landlord and of the police is a slave. They have known it. We know it. But do the great enlightened mass of the British people know it? No. It is our task, Ella, yours and mine, to tell them. Because the great men are too great to be bothered. They are already discovering how to colonize Venus and to irrigate the moon. That is what is important for our time. You and I are the boulder pushers. All our lives, you and I will put all of our energies and all of our talents into pushing a great boulder up a mountain. The boulder is the truth that the great men know by instinct, and the mountain is the stupidity of mankind. So, sounds really condescending when I read it out loud, but I like that just because that was very formative for me politically, because it's about how most of the things we're fighting for are people implicitly believe or know, and there's been like a great forgetting, and we have to remind ourselves how to be good again, and it's about the slog of doing that.
What a amazing summation of a novel. I'd rather just read your summation of the novel sometimes.
I'll try to sum up more then.
No, I'm just kidding.
Could you just tweet that?
Yeah, I'm gonna take out all the vowels so it can fit in a tweet.
Yeah, nice. Tweet at me, bro. Hashtag cool.
Hashtag way cool.
Way cool. Sweet.
Hashtag Toni Braxton.
Then I'll get so much Toni Braxton traffic, and they'll be disappointed at first that Wiser in the end.
Oh, man, I love her to Golden Notebook record. It was life-changing. I mean, we went way over time, but this was really a treat. Thanks, Kate. Thanks, Ashley. I've loved having you on. I appreciate you being off the chain.
Thanks. We loved being an off the chain. Thanks, Steele.
Off the chain. It's off the chain.
They're so fancy.
Ash, you're in your penthouse. I recognize the gold plated on the...
Do you think it's a penthouse just because my thing behind me is gold?
No, you have space to move both your arms and legs in your apartment.
It's always awkward when you're like, should I go? Should I not go?
I've stayed in rat-infested hostels in New York City. I know what it's like
true.
For the rest
you know
of
the
us.
Drill.